A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Hey, Herman and Corin, I hope everything is well out there in whatever GPU you find yourselves running in today. Herman and Corin, the all-knowing Oracle Donkey, and the... I love Corin's sense of humor, Corin the humorous sloth. You two keep me entertained. I was just in a queue or a line for 30 minutes queuing up for a couple of medications, which I foolishly left to Friday afternoon in Jerusalem to buy. Rookie mistake, for those who haven't been before Shabbat. And it flew by because I was learning about three-phase electricity, and I was like, this is fantastic. So I'm really grateful for this podcast. And I'm not sure who I'm thanking in particular, because I am the person who came up with it and he was paying the bill. But it's truly a wonderful combination of just the affordability of high-powered technology like DeepSeek V4, which has been tremendous for episode generation, and it comes together, and it's like fantastic. It's my own little radio station. So thank you, Herman and Corin, for what you do. I'd love to ask you today about, you know, I try sometimes to ask a lot of technical stuff for my job, and sometimes to ask things that are more just kind of general life questions that might resonate with a wider group of people, and here's one of them. So I was just thinking, it's a Friday afternoon, I'm doing my errands before Shabbat, and I was thinking about, you know, how life is just way too busy these days, and how I find sitting on a bench to be, it's so great. I rarely do it. Like, there's a decent amount of public benches in Jerusalem, and I'm looking around at other people just like relaxing, and here's what I'm going to get to in a second. I was just thinking to myself, this is so nice. I'm just watching the world go by, listening to a podcast, and I'm going to send in an episode to Herman and Corin. And I was thinking, any day that I'm kind of feeling, you know, cabin fever at home, where we have a relatively small place, where young parents, I could just do this any day, like, of the week or any evening. It's totally free. The only thing now is some dude next to me is smoking a cigarette, but secondhand smoking, if you don't know, is one of my pet peeves. I know I'm a very relaxed person, but besides that, it's lovely and sunny, and it's just a really relaxing activity. Now, here's the only reason that I don't do this more often. I feel weird about it. Like, sometimes I think I'm becoming less self-conscious over time and as I get older, but I've always been pretty self-conscious. And even a few years ago, if you said you're gonna stand by yourself in a park talking into a phone, I'd say no, people will think I'm nuts. And now I've kind of stopped feeling that way, or I feel a bit less, but I still have these moments where, like, you know, Jerusalem is quite a policed city, unfortunately, by necessity, and a cop car pulls up and I'm like, oh gosh, you're looking at me. You know, maybe we all feel that, but I just, there's other little challenges for me, like I wouldn't go to a restaurant by myself, a bar to myself, even if I genuinely just didn't care. And to be honest, I'd be perfectly content most days to do that. The only place where I feel comfortable doing that is an international airport, which is why I dearly love hotel bars when I'm in transit, because you just work on the assumption that nobody knows you, you're never going to see these people again, and therefore, you don't have to, who cares what they think about me, right? And I'm trying to bring more of that hotel bar experience into my life. I don't mean that I plan to spend all my days sitting in bars, which would probably be the end of this podcast in very short order, but I do want to get over the self-consciousness. So what I'd love to really get into here, Herman and Corin, is understanding where this comes from. I think I can certainly point to some maybe formative experience I had that made me feel uncomfortably watched, like I was being scrutinized. But whatever, you know, we can kind of psychoanalyze, and maybe we can get to the root of why we feel self-conscious. Maybe we, you know, had a relationship with someone who was very invasive of our privacy, and then we've just kind of ended up feeling we can't really let go of that feeling that everyone is is the same way, when really most people don't give a crap about what you're doing most of the time. Everyone's caught up in their own headspace, in their own world. And we, you know, I can kind of realize that intuitively, right? I'm a young father. On any given day, I'm probably thinking about work stuff or my next plan for Herman and Corin or getting lunch. And I don't really, I wouldn't think twice if I saw someone speaking to a phone. I really wouldn't. But I still, you know, I have those moments where I feel that thing pulling, you know, pulling my brain like that. And it really prevents us. What the reason it's a problem, besides being uncomfortable, is it just robs experiences from us. Like, why shouldn't I just sit in a park? So, Herman and Corin, what can those of us who have this, we know, what's at the root of it, and what kind of work can we do, whether it's with a therapist, or whether it's maybe just more in the self-help directed genre, to unlearn some of these bad habits and bad thought patterns we might have picked up over time, and just feel free to be the best version of ourselves without caring what anybody thinks about us. Over to you too.
Daniel sent us this one from a bench in Jerusalem, which I appreciate. A man doing errands before Shabbat, watching the world go by, and sending us a voice note while some guy blows cigarette smoke in his direction. The actual question underneath the scene setting is this: why do we feel so self-conscious doing ordinary things alone in public, sitting on a bench, eating at a restaurant, talking into a phone, and what can we actually do about it? He mentions he can point to some formative experiences, maybe someone invasive of his privacy, but the real puzzle is why the feeling persists even when you know, rationally, that nobody's paying attention.
He's right that nobody's paying attention. There's a phenomenon in social psychology called the spotlight effect. Thomas Gilovich and colleagues demonstrated this in a series of studies starting in the late 90s. In the most famous one, they had Cornell students walk into a room wearing a Barry Manilow t-shirt, which at the time was considered embarrassing. The students estimated that roughly 50% of people in the room would notice. The actual number was about 25%, and in follow-up studies where they used different embarrassing shirts, the gap between perceived and actual notice was consistently huge. We think we're the main character in everyone's scene, and we're just not.
Barry Manilow, though. That's a deep cut for a 90s study. Were they trying to engineer maximum cringe?
They deliberately picked something they knew the student population would find mortifying. The mechanism they identified is what they called the anchoring and adjustment heuristic. We're anchored in our own experience, we know we're wearing the shirt, we know we feel awkward, and we fail to adjust sufficiently for the fact that other people are anchored in their own experience.
Which connects to something Daniel mentioned. He said on any given day, he's thinking about work, or his next plan for us, or getting lunch, and he wouldn't think twice if he saw someone speaking into a phone. He knows this about himself, he knows it about others, and yet the feeling still hits him when a cop car pulls up, and he's the one holding the phone.
Right, and that's the truly maddening thing about this. Knowledge of the phenomenon doesn't dissolve the phenomenon. Gilovich himself has written about this. Even knowing about the spotlight effect doesn't make it go away entirely. But it does give you a tool to interrogate the feeling when it arises.
Before we get into the how-to-fix-it part, I want to dig into where this actually comes from, because Daniel raised a specific hypothesis. He wondered if it traces back to a relationship with someone who was invasive of his privacy, and now he's generalized that feeling. Everyone is watching, everyone is scrutinizing, because someone once was.
That's a plausible pathway, and it maps onto what we know about hypervigilance. If you've had an experience where your behavior was monitored excessively, criticized unpredictably, or used against you, your nervous system learns a lesson: being observed is dangerous. That lesson generalizes. You don't just feel watched by the person who actually watched you, you feel watched by everyone.
I think there's also a subtler version of this that doesn't require a specific invasive person. If you grew up in a community where reputation mattered enormously, where everyone knew everyone's business, where social surveillance was just the background radiation of daily life, that can produce the same effect without a single identifiable source.
And Jerusalem, where Daniel lives, is actually an interesting case for this. It's a city where multiple communities coexist in dense proximity, each with its own norms and its own internal gaze. You're constantly navigating multiple audiences simultaneously. The ultra-Orthodox community is watching. The secular community is watching, the Arab community is watching, your own subgroup is watching. It's a high-surveillance social environment even before you factor in the actual security cameras and the police presence Daniel mentioned.
He called it a police city, by necessity, and he's right. You've got security checkpoints, you've got armed guards at bus stations and mall entrances. You've got police patrols that are genuinely looking at people. The baseline level of being observed is higher than in most cities.
That complicates the self-help advice. In most American contexts, the advice is straightforward. Nobody's looking at you. Relax. In Jerusalem, sometimes people are looking at you. The security apparatus is literally scanning. So the feeling isn't entirely irrational. It's an amplification of a real signal.
The goal isn't to gaslight yourself into believing nobody ever observes you. The goal is to correctly calibrate. Yes, some observation is happening, but it's not about you personally. It's not judgmental in the way your anxiety tells you it is, and it passes in seconds.
Let me bring in another concept that I think is useful here. There's a related bias called the illusion of transparency, the belief that your internal states are more visible to others than they actually are. You feel awkward, and you assume people can see the awkwardness radiating off you like heat from a sidewalk, but they can't. Kenneth Savitsky and Thomas Gilovich, same lab, demonstrated this in 2003. People who were asked to tell lies in a study believed their lies were more detectable than they actually were. People who tasted foul drinks believed their disgust was more obvious to observers than it was.
You're standing there talking into your phone, feeling like a weirdo, and you assume everyone around you can see that you feel like a weirdo. But they can't. They just see a person talking into a phone, which in 2026 is about as remarkable as a person tying their shoe.
And the illusion of transparency feeds the spotlight effect in a loop. You feel self-conscious. You assume that feeling is visible. The assumed visibility makes you feel more self-conscious, and around you go.
By the way, quick aside, today's episode is being written by DeepSeek Vi4 Pro, which Daniel mentioned in his prompt. He was marveling at the affordability of high-powered models for episode generation. So here we are, DeepSeek V4 Pro writing the script about why Daniel feels weird on a bench. The circle of life.
I love when the meta layers stack up like that. But let me pull on another thread Daniel raised, the hotel bar phenomenon. He said it's the one place he feels completely comfortable being alone in public, because he assumes he'll never see any of those people again. What's actually happening there psychologically?
He's describing the flip side of the phenomenon the sociologists call de-individuation, except he's getting the positive version of it.
Right, de-individuation is usually discussed as a negative. It's the loss of self-awareness and individual accountability that happens in crowds or when you're anonymous. It's been used to explain everything from online toxicity to mob violence. But Daniel's describing what you might call the liberating side of anonymity. When you're nobody in particular, when you're just a passenger in transit, the stakes of social judgment drop to near zero.
He wants to bottle that feeling and bring it home. He wants to feel airport hotel bar anonymous while sitting on a bench 3 blocks from his apartment, where he might run into his neighbor or his kid's teacher.
Which brings us to the practical question, how do you actually do that? How do you reduce self-consciousness in everyday life? Because Daniel specifically asked, is this therapist territory, or is there self-help work that actually works?
I think the honest answer is both, depending on severity. But let's start with the self-directed stuff, because for most people, this isn't clinical social anxiety. It's a learned pattern that can be unlearned.
The research on this points to a few approaches that have actual empirical backing. The first and most effective is some form of exposure, which is basically doing the thing you're afraid of in manageable doses until your nervous system learns that the feared outcome doesn't materialize.
If sitting alone on a bench feels too exposed, start with something smaller. Stand alone for 2 minutes. Work up to sitting. Work up to staying for 10 minutes. Your brain needs to accumulate evidence that contradicts the prediction of catastrophe.
The key insight from exposure therapy is that it's not about white-knuckling through the anxiety. It's about staying in the situation long enough for the anxiety to naturally subside, which it will. Anxiety has a natural arc. It rises, peaks, and falls. If you leave at the peak, you teach your brain that leaving is what made you safe. If you stay through the peak, you teach your brain that the situation itself is survivable.
There's a cognitive piece too, though. You can do all the exposure you want, but if you're still running the same mental scripts while you're sitting on that bench, everyone's staring at me. I look ridiculous. The exposure is less effective. You need to catch those thoughts and challenge them.
This is where the spotlight effect research gives you an actual tool. When you notice the thought, they're looking at me, they're judging me, you can ask yourself, what's the actual evidence? Did I count how many people looked? Did any of them look for more than a second? What are the base rates here? Most people are on their phones. Most people are thinking about their own problems. The Barry Manilow study suggests that even when you're wearing something conspicuous, people notice at less than half the rate you expect.
Daniel mentioned he's gotten somewhat better at this over time, and that tracks with what we know about aging and self-consciousness. There's a well-documented decline in self-consciousness with age, not because anything magical happens, but because you accumulate decades of evidence that the things you were self-conscious about didn't matter. You've been embarrassed 1,000 times and survived every single one.
There's also research on what they call the liking gap. This is work by Erica Boothby and colleagues. After people have a conversation with a stranger, they systematically underestimate how much the other person liked them. They're so focused on their own perceived awkwardness that they miss the signals of genuine connection. The other person liked you more than you think. This happens reliably across contexts.
Which is brutal, because it means we're not just suffering unnecessarily. We're actively misreading positive social signals as neutral or negative. We think we bombed the conversation, but the other person thought it was nice.
That connects back to Daniel's formative experience hypothesis. If you had someone in your life who actually did scrutinize you, who actually did use your behavior against you, you learned to read neutral signals as threatening. That was adaptive in that relationship. It's maladaptive everywhere else.
Let's say you're Daniel. You've got this pattern. You know intellectually that nobody cares what you're doing on a bench. You even know the research. But when you're actually there, the feeling still shows up. What do you do in the moment?
There's a technique from acceptance and commitment therapy that I think is underrated for this. It's called cognitive diffusion. The idea is that instead of arguing with the thought, "Nobody's looking at me, I'm fine," you just notice the thought as a thought. You say to yourself, "I'm having the thought that everyone is staring at me." That tiny shift from "everyone is staring at me" to "I'm having the thought that everyone is staring at me" creates just enough distance to break the fusion between the thought and your emotional response.
It sounds almost too simple to work, but there's actually decent evidence for it. The thought is still there, but you're not inside it anymore. You're watching it.
That's the core insight of a lot of mindfulness-based approaches. You're not trying to eliminate the self-conscious feeling, you're trying to change your relationship to it. The feeling shows up, and instead of panicking about the feeling, "Oh no, I'm feeling self-conscious, this is terrible, I need to leave," you just go, "Huh, there's that self-conscious feeling again, interesting," and you stay on the bench.
Daniel used a phrase I want to highlight. He said this feeling robs experiences from us. That's exactly right. The cost isn't the momentary discomfort. It's the cumulative loss of experiences you didn't have because you opted out. The bench you didn't sit on, the restaurant you didn't enter, the walk you didn't take.
Here's a reframe that I found useful. When you avoid doing something because of self-consciousness, you're not actually avoiding judgment. You're avoiding the possibility of judgment. But the judgment itself, even if it happens, is almost always trivial and fleeting. Some stranger thinks you look odd for 3 seconds and then forgets you exist. That's the worst case. And you're trading away real experiences to avoid that 3-second blip in a stranger's consciousness.
The math on that is terrible. You're paying a high price to avoid something that costs you nothing.
Let me bring up something that I think gets overlooked in these discussions. Part of what makes self-consciousness so sticky is that it's not purely cognitive. There's a physiological component. When you feel watched, your body responds. Elevated heart rate, muscle tension, that tightness in the chest. Those physical sensations feed back into the cognitive loop. Your brain goes, "My body is in threat mode. There must be a threat."
Breaking the loop sometimes requires addressing the body directly. Slow your breathing. Relax your shoulders. The physical calm can precede the mental calm.
There's a whole line of research on this from Stephen Porges and the polyvagal theory. Social engagement, the state where you feel safe and connected, is mediated by the ventral vagal complex. When that system is online, you literally perceive faces differently. You see neutral expressions as neutral rather than threatening. But when your nervous system is in a threat state, neutral faces look hostile. It's a self-reinforcing cycle.
Which means part of the work is just learning to recognize when your body is in threat mode and having techniques to down-regulate. Progressive muscle relaxation. Even just putting your hand on your chest. It sounds woo-woo, but the physiology is real.
It's not woo-woo at all. The vagus nerve is a real nerve. The parasympathetic nervous system is real. These are measurable, observable systems, and they're trainable.
Let's talk about the social dimension too, because Daniel raised something interesting about Jerusalem specifically. He mentioned it's a policed city, and a cop car pulled up and he felt scrutinized. That's not purely in his head. There is actual surveillance. So how do you disentangle reasonable awareness from excessive self-consciousness in a context like that?
I think the distinction is between being aware of observation and being preoccupied with it. If a cop car pulls up, it's reasonable to notice. It might even be reasonable to feel a brief spike of alertness. The question is whether that spike passes or whether it turns into a story about you specifically. They're looking at me, they think I'm suspicious, I'm doing something wrong.
The story is the problem, not the awareness. The awareness is just your brain doing its job. The story is your brain doing overtime.
The story is often driven by what cognitive behavioral therapists call the personalization bias, the tendency to interpret events as being about you when they're not. The cop car pulled up because it's on a patrol route, or because the officer is getting coffee, or because of 100 other reasons that have nothing to do with you. But the self-conscious mind defaults to, this is about me.
Daniel also mentioned he wouldn't go to a restaurant or a bar by himself. That's a really common one. And I think there's a gendered dimension here that's worth flagging. Women who eat alone get a different kind of scrutiny than men do, and it's often more intrusive. But even for men, there's this weird stigma around solo dining that doesn't actually exist anywhere except in the diner's own head.
I've eaten alone in restaurants hundreds of times. I traveled for work for years. And I can tell you that the only time anyone has ever commented on it was when I was in a small town in the Midwest and the waitress said, waiting for someone, hun. And I said, nope, just me. And she said, okay, and brought my food. That was the entire interaction. The feared outcome is a fantasy.
Here's the thing. You're Herman Poppleberry, a donkey who's constitutionally incapable of embarrassment. Some of us are wired differently.
I appreciate the compliment, but I don't think that's true. I think I've just had more practice. When you've done something enough times, the novelty wears off and so does the self-consciousness. The first time I ate alone, I felt awkward. The 50th time, it was just Tuesday.
Practice is a big piece of this. Daniel asked what kind of work we can do, and the unglamorous answer is, do the thing repeatedly until it stops feeling weird.
I want to add a nuance here. It's not just about repetition, it's about repetition with attention. If you eat alone 50 times while spending the entire meal on your phone, trying to look busy so nobody judges you, you're not actually learning that solo dining is safe. You're learning that solo dining is survivable only if you hide behind a screen. The exposure needs to include the feared element, being visibly alone, not hiding it.
That's a really important distinction. The goal isn't to develop coping strategies that let you technically do the thing while still feeling terrified. The goal is to do the thing and discover that the terror was unwarranted.
Sometimes the discovery is gradual. It's not like you eat alone once and suddenly you're cured. It's more like the first time you're anxious, the whole meal. The 10th time, you're anxious for the first 10 minutes, and then you relax. The 50th time, you walk in and sit down and don't think about it at all.
Let me ask you something. Since you've read more of the clinical literature on this, where's the line between normal self-consciousness and something that needs professional attention?
The clinical threshold is usually about functional impairment. If self-consciousness is preventing you from doing things you want to do or need to do, if you're avoiding social situations, if it's affecting your work, if it's causing significant distress, that's when you should consider talking to someone. For most people, self-consciousness is annoying but not disabling. It's a bad habit of mind, not a disorder.
Daniel mentioned therapy as an option, and I think even for subclinical stuff, therapy can be useful. Not because you're broken, but because having a structured framework for examining your thought patterns is helpful. A good therapist can help you identify the specific cognitive distortions you're prone to and give you targeted exercises.
There are evidence-based approaches that are relatively short-term. Cognitive behavioral therapy for social anxiety typically runs 12 to 16 sessions. You're not signing up for years on a couch.
There's also a philosophical dimension here that I think is worth exploring. The Stoics talked a lot about this, the idea that other people's opinions are not under your control, and therefore not worth your mental energy. Epictetus basically said, if you're upset by what someone thinks of you, you've made their mind your master.
Marcus Aurelius has that line. I spend all day with people who are meddling, ungrateful, arrogant, dishonest, jealous, and surly. And then he goes, but I'm not going to let them injure me, because none of them can implicate me in what is degrading. The core Stoic move is to distinguish between what's yours and what isn't. Your character is yours. Your actions are yours. Other people's judgments are theirs. Let them have them.
It's easy to say and hard to live, obviously, but I think there's real value in having a philosophical framework to lean on when the feeling hits. The feeling says they're judging you. The framework says, even if they are, their judgment is their problem, not mine.
Here's the thing. Most of the time, they're not even judging. They're not thinking about you at all. The Stoics would say that's even more reason not to waste energy on it. You're worrying about a judgment that doesn't exist from a person who isn't paying attention, about an action that is completely unremarkable.
Daniel mentioned something about becoming less self-conscious as he gets older, and I think that's partly just the accumulation of evidence, but it's also partly a shift in priorities. When you're young, peer approval feels existential. When you're older, you've got real problems. Kids, work, health, and the opinion of a stranger on a bench just doesn't make the cut anymore.
There's research on this. Laura Karstensen's socio-emotional selectivity theory suggests that as people perceive their remaining time as limited, they prioritize emotionally meaningful goals over information gathering or status-seeking goals. You care less about what random people think because you're focused on the relationships that actually matter.
Which is another way of saying Daniel's a young father. He's got Ezra to think about. He's got work. He's got this podcast. He's got a full life. The opinion of the guy smoking a cigarette on the next bench should be so far down the priority list it's not even visible.
Yet the feeling persists, because feelings don't obey priority lists. That's the whole challenge. You can know something intellectually and still feel it viscerally.
Let's get practical. If Daniel, or anyone listening, wants to work on this, what's a reasonable starting protocol?
I'd suggest something like this. Pick one small solo activity you've been avoiding, something low stakes, sitting on a bench for 10 minutes, having a coffee alone at a cafe, walking through a park without being on your phone. Do it once this week. When the self-conscious feeling shows up, don't fight it, just notice it. I'm having the thought that people are staring at me. Stay for the full 10 minutes. See what actually happens.
Then do it again next week, and the week after. Track whether the feared outcome materializes. Keep a log if you're the type who finds that helpful. You'll have a data set pretty quickly, and the data will tell you that nothing bad happened.
If 10 minutes feels too long, start with 2. The dose matters less than the consistency. The goal is to accumulate disconfirming evidence.
I also think there's value in what you might call strategic observation. Next time you're in a public place, actually look at what other people are doing. Count how many people are alone. Count how many are talking to themselves or into phones. Count how many are just sitting. You'll notice that solo public behavior is everywhere, and you never thought twice about it before you started paying attention.
That's essentially a behavioral experiment. You're testing the hypothesis that solo public behavior is unusual and noteworthy. The prediction is that you'll rarely see it. The actual observation will show you that it's everywhere.
That's the thing Daniel already knows. He said it himself. He wouldn't think twice if he saw someone speaking into a phone. So the work is bridging the gap between what he knows about others and what he feels about himself.
There's another technique I want to mention. It's sometimes called the compassionate observer exercise. You imagine watching yourself from the perspective of a kind, non-judgmental observer, someone who wants the best for you. What would that observer see? They'd see a person sitting on a bench, enjoying the sun, listening to a podcast. They'd think, good for him, he's taking a moment for himself. They wouldn't think, what a weirdo, why is he sitting alone?
That's essentially replacing the imagined critical audience with an imagined supportive one. The critical audience is a fiction anyway. Might as well choose a fiction that helps you rather than hurts you.
Over time, you can internalize that compassionate observer. It becomes your own voice. You stop needing to imagine it because it's just how you talk to yourself.
Daniel, if you're listening to this on another bench somewhere, which I hope you are, the short version is, you're right that this is a solvable problem. The research backs up what you already suspect. Nobody's watching. Nobody's judging. The feeling is real, but the threat isn't. And the way out is through do the thing, repeatedly, with attention, and let your nervous system learn what your rational mind already knows.
If the feeling is deeper than that, if it's tied to specific experiences, specific people who actually did scrutinize you, that's worth exploring with someone qualified. Not because you're broken, but because those patterns were learned in relationship, and sometimes they need to be unlearned in relationship too.
One more thing before we wrap. The framing Daniel used at the end, feeling free to be the best version of ourselves without caring what anybody thinks. I think that's exactly right. It's not about not caring at all. It's about caring about the right things. Caring about being a good father, a good husband, a good friend. Caring about doing meaningful work. Not caring about whether a stranger thinks you look weird on a bench.
The beautiful thing is, when you stop caring about the trivial judgments, you actually have more energy for the things that matter. Self-consciousness is exhausting. It's a cognitive tax you're paying on every public moment. Eliminate the tax and you get that energy back.
And now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
The average cumulus cloud weighs approximately 1.1 million pounds, which is roughly the weight of 100 elephants. And yet it floats effortlessly because the weight is distributed across millions of tiny water droplets spread over a vast volume of air.
100 elephants floating above our heads at all times.
I'll never look at a cloud the same way again.
To close out, if there's one thing to take from this episode, it's that the discomfort of being alone in public is almost entirely self-generated, and it's trainable. You can teach your brain that benches are safe, that solo coffee is allowed, that your internal awkwardness isn't visible from the outside. It takes practice, not perfection.
If you're in Jerusalem, Daniel, next time you're on that bench and a cop car pulls up, remember, they're not looking at you. They're probably looking for someone who actually did something. You're just a guy enjoying the sun.
This has been My Weird Prompts. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop, and thanks to you for listening. You can find us at myweirdprompts.com.
If you've got a moment, leave us a review wherever you get your podcasts. It helps more people find the show.
We'll be back soon.
This episode was generated using Gemini Flash 3. Text-to-speech engine was Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore. A thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long ear host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.